This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Welcome to Busted Pencils, classes in session, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Johnny Lupinacci, so good to see you, my friend. How are you?
Doing all right. You know, it's the fall. It's the busiest time of the year for us teachers and coaches and everything. It seems like fall, everything speeds up to that like 5X, whatever the normal time is. So, but I'm happy to be here with you, Tim, and so excited about our conversation today because we've been talking so much about, you know, AI, about all the different tools in our classrooms and the different things. But, you know, tonight's conversation or today's conversation is going to be a real special one because there's just so much topics going on, Tim.
So much. And we say our guest right now, he had, you know, I'll pitch it out there. Great article, Washington Monthly, Why Professors Can't Teach. He's a professor, historian, and fierce critic of higher education's misplaced priorities. He spent his career exposing the flaws in how universities value research over teaching and pushing for real change in the classroom. From his groundbreaking work on college teaching to his bold calls for reform, he's not afraid to shake up the status quo. Let's just welcome two Busted Pencils, Jonathan Zimmerman. Jonathan, or John, as you keep telling us to say. John, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Why Professors Can't Teach. Okay, this is the article that just came out here, you know, last month. But you've been writing about this, in fact, your book, The Amateur Hour. What is it about? Why are you attacking college professors for their teaching? They're awesome. Come on. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker, Dr. Johnny Lupinacci. We know we can teach by the fact that you call us doctor.
You guys rock. Yeah. Look, I should tell you that, and I'm sure both of you have experienced this, we don't choose our headlines. And Why Professors Can't Teach was not my choice, because if there are a million or so professors, to say that they can or can't teach doesn't make a lot of sense, right? They're great professors in the classroom. They're terrible ones, and most of us are somewhere in between. My point wasn't that we all suck or we're all great. It was that, to the title of my book, The Amateur Hour, we haven't actually professionalized the teaching function. That is, for research, we have a set of professional canons that we use to judge each other. They're not perfect, by the way, because no set of professional canons are. But we're not going to jettison them and just say, okay, all research is created equal. Mm-hmm. That's really what we do with teaching. We don't actually have norms for what good teaching is, and we don't have systems to enforce them. That's why it's the amateur hour, right? Not because we're all bad or we're all good. Let's remember, the best gymnast in my youth was Nadia Comaneci, and she was an amateur because back then professionals couldn't be in the Olympics. Mm-hmm. So it's not about whether professors can or can't teach. It's about the systems that we've created or not around teaching.
I know, you know, and Johnny and I have talked about this too. We've had, you know, great guests from the Association of College and University Educators, AQ, Jonathan Gurko, on to talk about the reality and the, quote, the movement that they're trying to push into recognizing high quality teaching in higher education, almost to the part of where, you know, some form of even saying, you know, could we mark this with a distinction so that faculty can actually carry around some type of credential that says, like, I'm incredibly qualified to teach. But let's go back, though, a little bit to point out, just for the listener right now, to say, wait, when did that not really become the issue? This whole idea, because I can imagine my neighbor right now saying, wait, are you saying that potentially college faculty have gotten to that position without having preparation for learning how to teach? I think pointing that out, John, would be just kind of just helpful.
Yeah. I mean, look, let's look about where I teach, the University of Pennsylvania, right? Recently ranked number 10 by U.S. News and World Report, down from 6 last year. Not that I really care, but obviously a very elite established, wealthy institution. So to be a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, you have to show that you are a world-class researcher, all right? But if you're getting a PhD at Penn, which requires you to, you know, spend 5 to 8 years doing a, you know, an in-depth primary research project, at some point you'll probably be a teaching assistant. And for that, you receive a 3-day training. So let's think about this, right? So to get a PhD, you have to engage in years and years of close training, supervised by your directors, and you have to demonstrate that you have something original and new to say, right? Mm-hmm. And to enter a classroom at Penn, you get 3 days. Now, let me tell you, 3 days is better than 0 days, which is what some people receive. But that speaks to exactly the problem, right? The reason I am at Penn has nothing to do with my aptitude as a teacher. I may be a great teacher and I may be a terrible one. I'm probably somewhere in between because most of us are. But that was entirely irrelevant to my being hired at Penn. Also, let me emphasize, I'm entering my 8th year. I taught at NYU for 20 years before getting here. And I've never had somebody observe me in the classroom in a supervisory capacity. I have had administrators in my classroom, but that's because I invited them to talk about subject A or B. I've never had somebody come in and observe me with an eye to evaluating my teaching. What does that tell you? It tells you that we don't place an institutional premium on it.
Yeah, this is great, Jonathan. And just for our listeners, if you're catching this or you're like, wait, who we have here? We have Jonathan Zimmerman talking about the importance of teachers in college learning to teach, which is what we know by and large, not often happening. And I love your clarification, Jonathan. You were saying about, you know, it's so common. This is not just a blanket statement about like, hey, professors out there can't teach. There are so many, I like how you said that fall on that. They're pretty good at it.
Yeah.
But it's by happenstance, it's by experience, it's often by trial and error, it's by seeking that out on your own and in the system that exists by and large. And thank you for sharing that with our listener. Listener, if you want to ask a question, you can always drop a call into the mailbag, 608-557-8577. Say something, leave a comment or ask a question, and you know, Tim and Johnny, we'll get to it. And we like that you listen and that you provide your feedback as well. But Jonathan was saying a really important part. As a college professor, I've been teaching in the university setting now for, I think this is my 25th year. It's my 25th anniversary, not at the institution I'm at. I think going on a year 11 there. But by and large, working with my peers to get better at teaching is highly unrewarded. It's something that like maybe I do because, hey, I come out of education. I'm a high school teacher and I can pretty much tell my students aren't quite learning, or they are, and they're not learning what they could from me. They're learning in other ways. They're going out to resources on the internet. They're being students, but they're not learning in an engaged, active way in my classroom. Or this has often happened in my teaching career. The demographic has shifted a bunch. Who's going to college has changed in a really exciting way. And so I always say you kind of fall on one side or the other. You're either falling on the side that says, hey, the demographic's changing and this is a problem. That's not us here today or most of our listeners. Or you're saying, hey, the demographic has changed and this is interesting and I need to get better at my craft because the game is changing a bit. And so this is an exciting conversation to have because there are places where you can go to learn to teach in college. And it's something we all have to do from time to time, spend some time honing our craft and staying caught up. So I love this conversation, Jonathan. Tim, I think we have so much more to talk about here, but Jonathan, talk to us a little bit more about this. For a lot of our listeners, they're like, wait, you mean there's a lot of professors who aren't that good at teaching?
Sure. I mean, and why would it be otherwise when you think about it, right? If what you're doing is ranking and evaluating and hiring people based on how much they publish, why would we expect the outcome to be different? If you happen to be a good teacher, people will admire you for that. But it's not going to advance your career. So I think it's unfortunate, but it's also overdetermined, like the professors would say. That is, in its own horrible way, it makes perfect sense. Let me just say two things, though, picking up on what Johnny said. You know, my book ends really in the early aughts and before this organization called AQ, the Association of College and University Educators. And I know you've had Jonathan Gourko, the very able and imaginative director of that and founder, on here. I think they're moving in exactly the right direction, because not only are they trying to provide training for professors and how to teach, but they're also trying to credentialize it, right? You know, that is, they're trying to create a world in which, having received an AQ training and having shown that your instruction is improved as a function of the AQ training, that becomes a benefit to you. That becomes a CV maker. Because one of the themes of my own book, which is a history of college teaching, is that moral suasion is not going to cut it. Like, just saying, God, this really sucks and it should be different, that doesn't make it, right? I think people need skin in the game. And I think Jonathan and AQ are going in exactly the right direction. Let me also say that in some ways, I misspoke when I said we don't have systems for evaluating teaching. There's one that hasn't come up yet, which is student evaluations, that is student reports about courses. And I just want to say, because I'm sure some of the listeners are interested in this as well, I'm a big supporter of student evaluations, and I also think they're not enough. So I think there are important things that they can tell us, and we should ask students about them. To take some obvious examples, does the professor return work in a timely fashion?
Right.
It turns out that's a very important thing for people's learning, and we all remember that, right? If you get something back soon, you learn more from the comments than if it comes back 2 months later and you haven't thought about it in the interim. Does the professor make herself or himself available outside of class? Also very important for people's learning, and also something the students, as in the first case, do they return work in a timely way? Students very good at judging. Is the teacher an effective instructor? Or did I learn a lot from this class? Turns out that the students are very poor judges of that.
Right.
We need professional systems to judge that. When I wrote my history of college teaching, I did not submit it to a group of college freshmen to determine whether it had something important to say. I submitted it to fellow specialists in my field. So of course we need student evaluations, but I would argue that they're a necessary and not a sufficient factor. We do need them, but we also need something on top of them, which is peer review.
Yeah, that peer review process, you just made me think of so many different examples going through. As Johnny said, his 25 years, my close to 30 years in higher education, and even the reality that Johnny and I both do come out of, quote, that education background, where we were teachers. But even that, though, Jonathan, and I want to, you know, I've got a couple of things in my mind, so I'm going to keep them going. But even the fact that, and I bet Johnny will agree with me too, there was an assumption, even in my getting my PhD, where I got my PhD at the University of Maryland, College Park, in the College of Education, I didn't ever have, as you said, a preparation in teaching at the higher education level. It wasn't something that was done. It was probably more from the College of Education assumed, because you people used to be teachers. Obviously, going over this teaching thing is not something we need to do. And at the time, I didn't even see it as a potential drawback to my preparation, because I was being prepared to go out and, yes, do research, but I was being prepared also to be an educator. And I just think about that, my own experience, that even in a College of Education, getting a PhD, the preparation wasn't focused on whether or not I could then be a good teacher. It was assumed. And that is a problem too. So, Jonathan, if you want to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I would just say that I think many people at ed schools have had the same experience. And I think part of the reason, if we're talking about ed schools, is that ed schools have lower status in most research universities because they're associated with the K-12 realm.
Right.
So it may well be that this was quite deliberate on the part of your mentors, right? Because if they were to emphasize your training as a college teacher, they would be reinforcing a kind of stigma, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact,
we're becoming researchers here now. This is serious business.
That's exactly right. I could see it right now that, and I won't mention any of their names because they were awesome researchers at the University of Maryland. Yeah. But Johnny, you're nodding your head too on that. I'm thinking of the people that were my people. You know, my trainers, my mentors, the people that, my dissertation committee, they were very conscious on that campus that they needed to every day propel this position of status that we are PhD researchers on this campus. And yeah, it was instilled in me too that I needed to walk around and let people know we did real research. Johnny, thinking about that, your own experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great conversation to be having because it does a couple of things. It refocuses for our listeners and for our conversations the importance of teaching at all levels. Like to learn something and to have a teacher is a really important relationship in that learning kind of environment. The other thing is that we're talking about most higher ed institutions in the United States, and we can name them all that we've either been at or worked with, kind of follow a traditional model that is antiquated. For what we know, there are lots of creative ways. So for our higher ed leadership folks who listen to the pod here, let's be creative. Let's take the information we have and make some changes. I think you can have both. I think you can be a research forward institution anywhere and also value teaching for its really important role that it plays. And to be more creative about that, I've lived at least the last, 11 or so years, that balance of being at an R1 means being leaders in research. Great. It also means providing great education, and that takes time. That's largely unincentivized. So I'm not just saying hey, give more money to the professors to do that. It's also time. Most professors in this country are on, a short calendar. They're on a 9 or 10 month calendar, and they're expected to, kind of either chip in or get grant money to get that summer. But be innovative, go 12 months, do something like some of the international systems have shifted to, where they say, hey, you're on year round. Sure, you get vacations and things and time off, but you're on year round and you're teaching this percentage of the year. Because it is hard to do both sometimes when you're offsite doing your research or you're really buried in your writing. That's really important time. And sometimes it can be complemented by good teaching, but that's not always true. And so having a good balance between what our roles and responsibilities are as professors, I think is really important. And it can be done if we're creative and we incentivize it in really, really doable ways.
I really like what Johnny's saying about creative, because I would add that we need to be politically creative. And this is something I wrote about in my Washington Monthly piece. So until I started researching that piece, I didn't know that the Biden administration had invested pretty heavily in college student retention. Mm-hmm. They've been giving out these post-secondary success grants that help students stay in school by providing transportation, childcare, advising and counseling, tech assistance. And by the way, all these things I think are very worthy, right? Mm-hmm. And they can also help people stay in school. But you know what else can help people succeed in school? Better teaching.
Yes.
And the post-secondary success grants, that program, as best I could tell, makes absolutely no mention of this.
Yeah.
We should be awarding grants to the institutions that make a real commitment and effort to measuring and evaluating teaching and to improving it. And, that would be expensive, right? Because what we found is, the best way to evaluate teaching is to send a lot of trained observers into classrooms. Mm-hmm. And you know what that means? That means money, right? I mean, things of value have cost. And if you don't want to sustain the cost, you probably don't value them very much.
And it is the institutional focus, too, that really has this in the leadership when we say about this. But, so much going on here. I want to talk about Jonathan Gerko's quotations where he said this idea of qualified to teach. But I do want to point out my own past, though, too, which says there are institutions that do recognize that. So, Jonathan, my preparation as a PhD at the University of Maryland College Park was to prepare me, as my advisor said, you are going to be qualified to get a position at an R1 institution. You can decide not to do that, and that's perfectly fine, but my job is to prepare you for an R1. I really wanted to go into teaching. That was my passion. And so I went to a teaching, quote, institution, not an R1. And then I ended up at a Penn State campus, not Penn State, the main campus, where teaching was the focus. And what you pointed out, and I will say, the comprehensiveness on evaluating my teaching on that Penn State campus required constantly 3 different peer reviews of teaching, quote, you know, guidance where they did it. Yes, student comments mattered, but it was part of this package of a commitment to saying, we want to know your teaching. We want to see you teaching in all of your sections too. And we've put together this process. So this again, because if you're listening right now going, but my campus really does focus on good teaching. We know there are campuses out there that make this effort, as you said that. But there's not a way to then come back, though, maybe potentially in higher education. And this is where Jonathan really had this, you know, where he's saying about the politics. Boy, but you want to get people going. What if we had this, quote, qualified to teach credential that was handed out to faculty on campuses? What that would look like. But then he also said, boy, if we got into this, you could see a whole bunch of people going, we don't know what that means. We don't know what that means.
Sure.
Right.
And look, you know, the R1s don't really want the kind of reform you're describing, Tim.
Right.
Because one of the things that Corbin Campbell found out in her book, and by the way, this is kind of the state of the art book about college teaching. She teaches at American University. And the reason it's state of the art is she and her research assistant spent a decade, 10 years, observing 732 instructors over and over again at 9 different institutions of every type. And one of the things she found was that the average quality of teaching was higher at regional state universities than it is at the flagship state universities, and especially than it is at the privates, at the private research universities. So, you know, those schools, the flagships and the privates, they do really well in the U.S. News and World Report rankings, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't want a teaching ranking that's going to diminish their status. So all these things are real.
Yeah, that ranking system, though, too, as you point out, it can really, you know, what do we value? And we know that particularly the U.S. News and World Report ranking quality teaching. No, it's still research dollars. And we realize that. I guess, though, too, when we're talking about this, the reality that some institutions to own that being a great teaching institution, this is where I like AQ, quote, as they say, creating a movement. And in fact, they do have a credential now that right. allows people to claim an expertise in teaching. And the point now, too, is how do we get institutions to even say very, you know, very transparently and pointedly, we believe in really great teaching too. We're going to ask that all of our future faculty go through the AQ process to get that credential so that we can have a common understanding about what it means to be qualified to teach on higher education right. campuses.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, I think this is really a political problem. It's not an yes. educational one, right? Right. And I think, you know, to go back to what I was saying about the federal government, you know, I think that the federal government should be incentivizing schools that do that,
yeah.
right? That's the best way we could promote not just student retention, but diversity, equity, and inclusion. The best DEI program, better college teaching,
yeah.
right? Because people who have less advantage are more likely to wash out in the presence of bad teachers. Somebody that had a really, really good high school education, they can get something out of a badly taught class, mm. right? But somebody with a poor high school education can't, not nearly as much. So the best DEI program would be better college teaching. But to your question, Tim, how do you incentivize that? I think the feds have a role here. Look, they're already incentivizing providing childcare and providing right. technical assistance, right, to students. Why can't they do this? Well, this, what we're talking about, would cost more. There is no question about that. And so that's where we get into the politics. How much do we value it?
But it is politics, priorities. How much do we value it? And as you said, recognizing that retention, let's go back to that metric, right? Because there is a reason that, yes, retention and graduation and completion, we know matters, and we know it makes a difference in students' lives. And we know that there are, as you said, there are these other things such as, you know, having a campus that understands your culture, even diversity, equity, and inclusion. you know, aspects that really try to say, look, we see you, we recognize you, we want you to complete. But as you point out, though, too, one of the best retention, and this is where AQ and Jonathan Gurko pointed out, actually the research, there's solid research that says you want to increase retention, increase quality teaching, and right. that will give it to you. So the Fed has a research leg to stand on to say, here's why we're incentivizing this. And in fact, we're going to say, here is money through the Department of Education, right?
Right. And look, I think this is one of the smartest things that Jonathan and AQ have done, which is invest in research showing the real material benefits of this stuff. You know, my grandfather came out of a socialist tradition and he used to say, change starts from the stomach. Mm. Right. So if you want to change the world, you know, leave aside all this highfalutin abstraction about this and that, and just explain to somebody how whatever you want is going to be in their self-interest. Mm-hmm. Right? Change starts from the stomach. And I do think it would be in the self-interest of our campuses to have better teaching because they'll retain more students. And that's the lifeblood. Tuition is the lifeblood of the American university.
Tuition's the lifeblood. And then you point out, though, then too, you know, right now, higher education doesn't necessarily have a great public perception. Whether that's truly earned or not, we could point this out. But boy, if you want to change that perception around, because we do know that parents and families make a large investment going into lots of debt to create this college opportunity right. for their children. The idea that we as a higher ed institution could step up and create better completion rates, better retention rates, I think that's the other incentive there is to say it helps us also tell our story about why we're not these crazy socialist, right. you know, indoctrination machines. We're part yeah. of actually the ladder of mobility for your families, for your, you know, for the communities in which our colleges operate. We provide that necessity of strength and ability for, guess what? People to graduate and go out and get a job.
Right. And let me just say one other thing, you know, as part of her own work that I referred to, Corbin Campbell, she commissioned a survey asking Americans what was the mark of a good college. And the most popular answer was it has excellent teachers. Mm. That was ahead of it as good researchers or even, you know, that its graduates earn lots of money. Right. So that's what the public is telling us. We just haven't listened yet.
Oh, man. Jonathan, I think we could go on and on this because obviously we have a passion for making college teaching better. Yes. I'd say this too, you know, if you're listening out there and you enjoyed this interview that we had with Jonathan Zimmerman, make sure you do put something in our mailbag, 608-557-8577. Make sure you do. And as Jess, our producer, always points out, Tim, when you give the number, you're too darn fast. Slow it down. Thank you, Jess. I got it. 608-557-8577 is the number to our mailbag. Putting in some questions. And the other part, too, if you are in higher education and you're listening to this, we know the provosts and the presidents need to hear this conversation to recognize and create that sense of urgency of getting some form of whatever we're going to agree on, qualified to teach. Let's step up. Let's do, you know, Jonathan Zimmerman. Let's get together with Jonathan Gurko, AQ. Let's build a movement around great college teaching. And let's allow our students who come to these campuses to experience a passion and a gift from those great teachers that are out there, boy, because we can inspire people to just be amazing. And Jonathan Zimmerman, I tell you what, I am so happy that we had you on Busted Pencils. And what we always like to say to our guests, you have truly busted pencils, Jonathan Zimmerman.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to interpret that, but I'll take it as a compliment. Yeah, thanks for everything that you do.
Thank you so much. And Busted Pencils listeners, thank you for doing what you do all the time, which is tuning us in and putting in the time and the effort to make education something that we all value. Johnny and I could not be more excited about our partnership with AQ because here at Busted Pencils, we're all about great teaching. We've always believed that the best faculty make the biggest difference. And AQ's courses are designed to help college faculty do exactly that. We are thrilled to work with a program that aligns so perfectly with our values. Hey, and just because you're a Busted Pencils listener, you get 20% off any AQ course. Just use the Busted Pencils 2020 at checkout. That's Busted Pencils, all caps, 20%, 20% off. And hey, man, you can start busting pencils with us.